Good morning. Welcome to Rising, and we have a great show for you today with a great guest lineup. And Batya Ungar-Sargon is in studio in D.C. with us for it. So nice to see you, Batya.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
All right. Well, what is going on?
So we'll be discussing everything election related, plus former party chair and 2020 Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang will be here. And our Rising panel is back. We'll discuss the role crime and public safety played in driving voters to the polls last week, or didn't play. But first, two major races called over the weekend have secured Democrats Senate control. Catherine Cortez Masto in Nevada and Mark Kelly in Arizona have both narrowly defeated their Republican challengers and won re-election, giving Democrats the 50 seats they need to retain power in the upper chamber. The only remaining outstanding Senate race is in Georgia. Democrat Raphael Warnock and Republican Herschel Walker are headed to a runoff there next month. Meanwhile, control of the House is still up in the air. Republicans are just 6 seats away from wresting power from the Democrats. However, several too close to call races means we'll just have to wait and see.
Now, as Team Blue celebrated the Cortez Masto and Kelly victories, here's what party leaders had to say over the weekend.
Well, I tell you what, congratulations to Senator Schumer. He's got a majority again, and we're focusing now on Georgia. We feel good about where we are. And I know I'm a cockeyed optimist. I understand that from the beginning, but I'm not surprised by the turnout. I'm incredibly pleased.
We won because we had a really good agenda that we actually passed that helped the American people on things they cared about.
This is such a cause for a celebration. Chuck Schumer was so correct when he said it was a victory for the people and for the country. I personally know that it's a joy to Harry Reid, wherever in heaven as he is, that his state came through with the victory that gave us the majority in the Senate.
So obviously, we haven't gotten your take yet on election results because you join us Mondays. It was a big surprise for a lot of us. Where's your head at?
Yeah, so my radar is going to be more in detail on what I think the media missed about it and why that happened. I think there's sort of two ways to look at it right now in terms of from the Democratic Party's point of view. You know, from one hand, you could say, well, because it was so predicted to be this red tsunami and that didn't happen, therefore the Democrats are correct that they now have a mandate to keep doing what they were doing, and that was the American people saying, we approve, keep going. The other interpretation, which is something you'll hear more likely here on Fox News, would be that, you know, it wasn't so much that they were saying yes to the Democrats as that they were saying no to the Trump wing of the Republican Party, and that's quite a different interpretation of how things fell out. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, and my radar will be more on Trump's contributions to this lovely outcome. Something else that we haven't really discussed yet that my friend Ben Domenech, who's on Fox News, brought up last night. I caught him on Mark Levin's show. He was pointing out that he thinks, and I think this theory is really smart, Trump may have given people the false impression that it is easy to just come out of nowhere and run for government and win. Because Trump had the benefit of running against Hillary Clinton, one of the most uniquely reviled political figures in all of American history, someone who opted not to campaign in the 2 swing states where the election was going to be decided. You're not always going to get that lucky. Dr. Oz, no political experience, celebrity, says, hey, maybe I can be a senator. Herschel Walker, same deal. Blake Masters had never sought political office before either. These were all people who had experience in maybe in public speaking. I don't know that that's true of Blake Masters, but who had no political experience, no experience winning elections. And you know what? That hurts. It helps you run savvier campaigns when you've done it before. I remember an elected official I used to know told me that a local official in Michigan told me he lost his first race, and that was the greatest gift that he could have ever gotten because it taught him so much. Losing teaches you something. These people were never tested before in the project of winning elections, and I think that came back to bite the GOP. So obviously we still don't know what's going to happen in Georgia. That's a ways off. I could see, but it doesn't matter. I mean, they have, with Nevada and Arizona wrapped up, the Democrats have a majority regardless. I tend to think that's going to mean the Republicans will be a bit demoralized in that race, and I could see Warnock winning just because the other side kind of has a, well, what's the point attitude? What do you think?
And well, what do you foresee the Democrats doing with this, you know?
Well, that's a...
Yeah, that's some results.
Policy-wise, I think, unfortunately, the effort to perhaps stall the unlimited payments to Ukraine, which was going to be part of a Republicans taking over. I think that was going to be a top priority, especially with the changes in the House. And the House is still changing hands, it looks like. I don't know if that's going to be as important to kind of pull back on that, because I know Ukrainian kind of partisans are very happy with the results. I mean, this is a massive win for Biden, and Biden has been the most kind of full-throatedly, we're going to stay the course here, they get whatever they want, maybe privately trying to push for negotiation. We're hearing some of that. But policy-wise, I don't see why this would be anything other than a massive continuation of what we've had. What do you expect?
Yeah, I mean, I think even if the Republicans take the House, a narrow margin is definitely going to limit them in terms of, you know, because their House is now divided on questions of foreign, you know, interventions, foreign policy, and so forth. I was very happy to see Jake Sullivan suggesting to Zelensky that maybe, you know, retaking Crimea is a little bit too far, but I guess we'll see what's going to happen.
There's all this infighting, the leadership fighting. There's a lot of Republican voices. I saw there was an open letter today that people like the Heritage Foundation's president signed it as well, calling for delay in a vote to approve McConnell and McCarthy as leader. They want to wait till the Georgia runoff takes place first. That is essentially like a de facto vote of no confidence in the current leadership, which makes some sense in that this was a disappointing result. I think it doesn't make sense in other ways that I'm going to get into in my radar, but there's just a lot of infighting and frustration that is going to, I think, hinder the GOP's effectiveness until they really get their house in order.
Right, but you know, for a lot of people, divided government is, you know, one of the building blocks of a good, strong democracy. A lot to look forward to.
Well, lots to look forward to in that. You're absolutely right. Well, we will get to those radars that we've teased for you so frequently through this section coming up next. Stay with us.
Robbie, what's on your radar?
Well, the GOP's hopes of controlling both chambers of Congress are officially over. The votes have been tallied in Arizona and Nevada, and both GOP challengers, Blake Masters and Adam Laxalt, have gone down to defeat, which means the outcome of the Georgia runoff won't actually affect control of the Senate. The Democrats already have 50 seats, plus Vice President Kamala Harris's tie-breaking vote. And the defeats of Laxalt and Masters cap off a, frankly, humiliating election week. Let's just call it what it is, for the GOP, which is projected to capture the House of Representatives by many fewer seats than conservatives expected. The red wave made landfall in Florida. Everywhere else, it was more like a trickle. As Republicans process what went wrong and try to understand precisely how they could have fared this badly against a deeply unpopular president and a horrible economy, they should consider that Democrats' pitch to voters, Trump and Trumpist candidates are existential threats to democracy, may have actually worked. Republican candidates who pledged fealty to Trump and made his backward-looking lies about a stolen election a centerpiece of their own campaigns badly underperformed on election night. No one better encapsulates this trend than Blake Masters, the Arizona candidate, who famously released a campaign ad last year in which his opening pitch to voters was, "I think Trump won in 2020. Let's watch that.
"I think Trump won in 2020. Maybe you disagree, but you've got to admit, this election was really messed up. We saw states change the rules at the last minute to flood the zone with mail-in ballots. The media, they'd tell any lie in order to hurt President Trump. And big tech censored true information about Joe Biden in the weeks leading up to the election. How is that fair? Trump wins big in a fair fight. I'm Blake Masters. I'm running for the U.S. Senate in Arizona. And I approve this message because election integrity is the most important issue. We got to do so much better if we want to keep this country great."
It's perfectly valid to complain that the media coverage of Trump was sometimes less than fair. And it's, of course, all well and good to say that big tech did its best to tip the scales for Democrats. But is relitigating 2020 really the most important issue facing struggling working class families in 2022? Is flatly asserting that Trump won the last election, a claim that is, to be clear, false, the best way to win new voters to the GOP? There's only one person who thinks this is the most important issue or a good thing to run on. And that person is Donald Trump. And in fact, Masters' odd campaign choices are largely due to Trump. Trump personally pressed Masters to lean into election fraud claims harder, telling him, quote, "You've got to go stronger on that one thing." And Masters dutifully obeyed, bringing it up constantly in interviews. That was his main issue. It was not persuasive to voters. Carrie Lake, the Republican candidate in the Arizona gubernatorial race, who similarly made election denialism a centerpiece of her campaign, if not more so, is also currently trailing her Democratic opponent, though this outcome is not certain at present. Now, Arizona's Laxalt hasn't been nearly as vocal about Trump's election claims since he decided to run for the Senate. But he was known to Nevada voters as someone who participated in Trump's legal efforts to overturn the 2020 outcome in the state. Laxalt came closer to winning than Masters, and I suspect that reflects the fact that his fealty to Trump was a little bit further in the rearview mirror than Masters was. But the result was the same. And it's not just in the Southwest. Elsewhere, hardcore Trump loyalists suffered similarly embarrassing losses. Doug Mastriano, the Republican candidate for governor in Pennsylvania, was an attendee at the January 6th protests in front of the U.S. Capitol, protests that were all part of Trump's effort to object to the outcome of the last election. That's how voters knew Mastriano, as a Trump guy and supporter of Trump's election lies. Guess what? Mastriano lost decisively. So did Pennsylvania Senate candidate Mehmet Oz. Georgia Senate candidate Herschel Walker also failed, though could still win the runoff. Neither Oz nor Walker had any political experience, nor were they well-liked by any contingent within the Republican Party's base. They got the nomination because they sucked up to Trump. That's what it was. Meanwhile, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican who refused to give credence to Trump's election lies, was easily reelected, landslide against Stacey Abrams, despite Trump's best efforts to sabotage him. He recruited a primary opponent for him. Trump's support undoubtedly a boon within Republican primary elections. The MAGA base is vocal, active, and numerous. But by forcing Republicans to humor Trump's claims about the 2020 election, he ultimately cripples his candidates. General election voters do not like this fixation. The GOP needs to attract moderates, independents, centrist Democrats who are worried about the country's direction, worried about inflation, gas prices, the failing education system, rising crime in many cities. These voters are winnable. We know that. Look at New York. Look at the gubernatorial outcome in New York, where the candidate there got close, closer than any Republican has gotten in recent memory. But there is plenty of evidence that Trumpist election denialism is just a non-starter for the voters the GOP needs. If believing that Trump won the 2020 election, as Blake Masters does, is a litmus test to secure the Republican nominations, then Republicans may find the red wave is a perpetual mirage. The GOP needs candidates who are forward-looking and who realize that Trump isn't doing them any favors. Masters had to learn that the hard way. Now, some conservatives believe that Mitch McConnell, rather than Donald Trump, deserves blame for what went wrong in Arizona. And they point out that McConnell's PAC did not spend money in that race. Masters himself blames McConnell. Here's what he told Tucker Carlson last week.
At best, just incompetent. But you know what else is incompetent, Tucker? The establishment, right? The people who control the purse strings. Senate Leadership Fund, Mitch McConnell. McConnell decided to spend millions of dollars attacking a fellow Republican in Alaska instead of helping me defeat Senator Mark Kelly. Had he chosen to spend money in Arizona, this race would be over. We'd be celebrating a Senate majority right now.
It's true that McConnell did not allocate funds for Masters' race, which feels like a big oversight. But overall, McConnell's PAC spent $230 million on Senate races, much of that going to Dr. Oz and to Herschel Walker. You know how much money Trump spent on his guys? $15 million. Indeed, Masters got a paltry $4 million from Trump, including via this fundraising webpage. Take a close look at this. You see, donors probably assumed the donation they made via this webpage was split between Trump and Masters. But if you read the fine print and click through, Trump was actually collecting $99 for every $1 that went to Masters. It's a scam. Luke Rosiak, a reporter for the Daily Wire, which is a conservative news site, not an anti-Trump site by any stretch of the imagination, points out that Democrats actually spent more money to help out Trump-backed candidates than Trump did. Democrats meddled in various Republican primaries because they wanted Trump-backed candidates on the general election ballot. That's because they knew they could beat those candidates, and they did in many races. Maybe it's time for Republicans to learn a lesson that apparently the Democratic Party has already figured out. So I totally get it. I have my qualms with the Republican establishment as well. McConnell's clearly didn't like Blake Masters, and that went both ways. But you could say he's got to be a big boy, and he should have helped out in that race. But Trump didn't help out very much in that race, nor did he help out anywhere else. He did not open up the coffers at all. So I think my point stands, which is that, look, there are two paths, and the path of and Blake Masters went so far out of his way to curry favor with Trump on the election claims. You cannot win a general election based on that. You just can't.
Yeah, I think that's such a great point where you point out that the Democrats actually spent more to help these people than Trump did. But on that front, so here's my question. You know, while the Democrats were funding these far-right Trumpist MAGA candidates against the sort of normie Republicans who might have been better able to defeat Democratic candidates, we in the media, we were like so horrified by this, right? It seemed like so, you know, anti-democratic, mm-hmm. just so kind of gross and cynical, right? But it worked, right? What is the take-home message from that it worked?
I mean, like, it's all fair. All's fair in politics. We're certainly within their legal rights to run ads,
100%.
You know, associating. Yeah. I think it was right for us to call it out because it undercuts the message the Democrats have that, you know, the integrity of our democracy is at stake, and Trump is different than other Republicans, and we just need to be, you know, get rid of him. Obviously, Democrats don't believe that. They don't believe that at all. But what they were saying worked. I think we have to concede that their message of Trump as existential threat worked, and it works because Trump supplies the other piece by still being a presence. And if Republicans want to do well, it's going to be hard. It's not going to be easy. But some way or another, got to show them the door. Maybe now that they have DeSantis waiting in the wigs with a huge success in Florida, that will be easier to do. But it seems to me that there's no other choice if they want to win elections in the future.
And certainly that is the message that we're getting from, you know, the Rupert Murdoch empire.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. All right, I'm looking forward to your radar, Batya. That'll be up next. What's on your radar, Batya?
Well, a week after the midterm elections that shocked the nation, it's only becoming clearer just how badly the media messed this one up. Americans were promised a red tsunami. Instead, President Biden had the best midterm elections of a sitting president in 20 years, and this despite his dreadful approval ratings. Every election that's been called since Tuesday has favored the Democrats, who have held the Senate and may even keep the House. To explain away the refusal of the electorate to obey the diktat of media prognosticators, a few narratives have taken hold. Some have argued that the Democrats' success is proof of how important abortion is to the American electorate. For others, the election was a referendum on Trump, proximity to the former president being one of the best predictors of whether a Republican candidate tanked. Still, others have seen in the results proof that candidate choice matters. You can't just run a stop-the-steal kook or an out-of-state TV doctor and expect voters to turn out because he's running on the Republican ticket. There's a bit of truth to all of these answers, but to me, they all miss a larger, more important point. Tuesday's results were less a loss for Republicans or a win for Democrats than they were a victory for depolarization. Americans showing up to the polls didn't vote for Democrats or against Republicans as much as they voted for shrinking the growing gap separating them. Call it the normie election. People who decided Tuesday's results were everyday Americans sick of the overheated political atmosphere that's bleeding out into everyday life. People who don't spend all day on Twitter or watching cable news or YouTube shows, who are sick of Facebook fights and Thanksgiving family brawls and just want a return to normal, to the good old days when you could just debate things cordially. By and large, voters rewarded moderation last Tuesday. Democrats, for example, performed better in close races than in safe seats, outperforming expectations in districts rated as toss-up or lean Democrat, and underperforming in districts rated as solid or safe, as David Shore pointed out. And as Josh Kraushaar points out, voters who told pollsters they somewhat disapprove of Biden backed, quote, normie Republicans while rejecting the MAGA candidates. They went for Brian Kemp over Stacey Abrams, but rejected Herschel Walker, for example, by the same margin. In race after race, voters rewarded candidates who represented the most reasonable version of their ticket. They went for candidates who they could picture, or who perhaps they had even seen, talking to someone that they themselves or even the candidate disagreed with. Consider Republican Mike Lawler's victory in New York's 17th district. Lawler ousted no less a figure than the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Representative Sean Patrick Maloney. Of course, Lawler had help. He had $6 million from a Republican super PAC and some helpful redistricting. But Lawler also ran a moderate campaign that was pitched at appealing to both the blue-collar cops, firefighters, and veterans in his district, as well as wealthy liberals in Rockland County and Chappaqua. Lawler, a son of Rockland, ran on crime, the economy, and the border, issues that unite working-class Americans across party lines. And crucially, he distanced himself from the Stop the Steal movement, making it clear he believes Joe Biden won the 2020 election. When asked about how he managed to pull off his victory, Lawler spoke about Democrats. Take a look.
My district has 70,000 more Democrats than Republicans. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't have won it without the support of many Democrats and independents. And I think people are excited about the opportunity and really looking for change. And, you know, this district is home to Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, George Soros. So it's a very diverse district.
So you're Hillary Clinton's congressman.
I am now Hillary Clinton's congressman.
And George Soros's congressman.
I look forward to hearing from them. In order to win this district, I needed to go everywhere and talk to everyone. And I can't be afraid because maybe there's some tough questions that come.
Lawler's was a victory for a man who made clear he was not going to be a tailwind for the most extreme forces in his party, who was unashamed of the fact that he was working to convince Democrats that he could represent them too. Indeed, he was proud of it. In a similar vein, both Representative Alyssa Slotkin and Representative Abigail Spanberger won their elections in Michigan's 7th and Virginia's 7th districts, respectively. The two are both Blue Dog Dems, proud moderates with backgrounds in the CIA, who won in 2018 as Democrats in red districts. Both Spanberger and Slotkin stand proudly for an independence of spirit, making a habit of taking on their own party, publicly rebuking progressives for extremism when warranted. Tonight, voters here made clear that the politics of division are not what they want for our families or our state, Slotkin wrote on Twitter in announcing that her challenger, Tom Barrett, had called to concede. Contrast that with Charlie Crist, the man who lost Florida to Governor Ron DeSantis in a humiliating double-digit defeat, who bragged to a reporter during the campaign that he didn't want Republicans to vote for him. Watch.
If you have that hate in your heart, keep it there.
It's quite the campaign strategy to suggest that anyone you haven't convinced to vote for you should just keep it that way. No wonder Chris lost so significantly. Floridians took his advice. But I suspect DeSantis's double-digit victory was fueled not just by Republicans, but by a lot of people who still identify as Democrats. It was something DeSantis made a point of noting in his acceptance speech.
Thank you to Miami-Dade County. Thank you to Palm Beach County. Now, we're still tallying the votes, but it's clearly apparent that this election, we will have garnered a significant number of votes from people who may not have voted for me 4 years ago. And I just want to let you know, I am honored to have earned your trust and your support over these 4 years.
DeSantis also explicitly thanked Miami-Dade County, a heavily Hispanic area that was once considered a Democratic stronghold. And he didn't just win Cubans either, who have always leaned conservative. DeSantis grew his share of the Puerto Rican vote by 20 points, from 34% in 2018 to 55% on Tuesday. How did he do it? Despite what the Democrats want us to believe, DeSantis is no right-wing extremist. He cruised to victory thanks to a record of governing Florida for the past 4 years as a populist, appealing to the middle and working class, irrespective of their party affiliation. DeSantis has figured out something that's lost on most politicians, that there are a lot of Americans who are culturally conservative and fiscally protectionist in both parties, who no one is speaking to. These voters are united on issues like COVID-19 lockdowns, sexualized messaging in early childhood education, and immigration. And on each of these issues, DeSantis took a big swing that signaled his willingness to represent this forgotten constituency and give them a voice. In other words, he took Trump's central insight, that the white working class has been abandoned by an elitist, leftist cultural hegemony that looks down on working Americans. And he expanded it to include working class Hispanics and working class liberals. To a smaller degree, I think the depolarizing normie midterms explains another poorly prognosticated race. Moderation may not be the first word that comes to mind when thinking of John Fetterman, who won his Pennsylvania contest for Senate against Mehmet Oz. But Fetterman won despite suffering a debilitating stroke during the campaign, thanks to what Al Weaver aptly called a go-anywhere strategy that focused on competing in rural counties across the state and holding the party line in the cities and suburbs. And he did it all in shorts, a hoodie, and visible tattoos, actively reversing the damage that Hillary Clinton had done to her party by spurning these very same rural white working class areas in 2016. Far from diminishing his appeal, I think the stroke that Fetterman suffered made him seem even more like the everyman he dresses as. Bald, overweight, and now sometimes verbally impaired, he's someone that voters can never imagine looking down on them. Unlike the millionaire with I don't even know how many houses I own, lecturing them about what to eat on television. He may come from privilege, but everything about him is a rebuke of elitism, including his stroke, and I think that voters rewarded him for his humility with their loyalty. Even abortion was less a win for Democrats than it was for the kind of libertarian, don't tread on me undercurrent of American life that knows no party. As Richard Hanania pointed out, the issue of abortion outperformed the Democrats who ran on it by a wide margin wherever it was on the ballot. In Michigan, an amendment to put the right to an abortion in the state's constitution passed with two more points than Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer won by. In California, a similar amendment passed 7 points ahead of Gavin Newsom. In Vermont, it was between 6 and 15 points ahead of the Democrats running. In Kentucky, a pro-life ballot failed on a day that voters handed Rand Paul a 23-point victory. And in Montana, an anti-abortion measure looks like it will fail with the same electorate that gave one of its Republican candidates a 35-point margin of victory. In other words, many, many Americans who did not vote for Democrats voted to keep abortion legal. Like the ticket splitting that happened in a number of other races, this speaks well for a return to a less polarized society that chooses issues and candidates with more flexibility and open-mindedness than we have been told to expect. At the end of the day, the biggest loser of Tuesday's midterms wasn't Trump or the Republicans so much as it was polarization itself, the division of America into two irreconcilable parties with competing sets of values that never shall meet. The biggest loser was the I don't want your vote faction of the political class. That's why the media missed it, because we are agents of polarization. The truth about our nation is often invisible to us because our entire business model is based on making people hate each other. Here's hoping this will be a wake-up call for the people charged with writing the first draft of American history. We should do a better job reflecting the decency of our subject going forward.
Yes, words to live by, Batya. And it is something, you know, we have to grapple with, that the mainstream media, you know, despite their professed fear of and hatred of Donald Trump, don't actually want him to go away from a business model standpoint. You know, being against Trump helped keep many media outlets alive, even as we're pivoting away from some of what establishment media represented. And so they're going to have terrible incentives if Ron DeSantis proves to be a formidable challenger to Trump, as I expect he will. They probably would prefer anyone to Trump in terms of who actually gets to be the president, but they're not the Trump headlines, which help him because they keep him in, because it reinforces it. By keeping him in the headlines, by criticizing him all the time, they make Republicans want to rally around him and give him better chances of holding on to power, which serves the business interests of the corporate mainstream media.
Right, 100%. And I think, you know, the American people were trying to tell the media and the pollsters we're voting on the issues, right? And what we heard was we're voting for Republicans, mm-hmm. right? Because it's so hard for us to imagine that Americans, average Americans, normie Americans, working and middle class Americans, they just are sick of both parties and they don't think about themselves in that way anymore, mm-hmm. as political.
Well, as we're sitting here discussing things, we have some breaking news from NBC News projecting that Republicans will indeed control the House after all, with 219 seats, Democrats holding 216 seats. By the thinnest of margins, Republicans will be able to elect the next Speaker of the House, unless they have too much internal dissent on that. We will see. Thank you so much, Batya. We'll have more Rising in just a minute.
In last week's midterms, the state of Nevada voted to make sweeping changes to their election system, which includes open primary elections in which the top five candidates advance and then ranked choice voting in general elections. Nevada now becomes the third state to approve ranked choice voting for elections, following Alaska and Maine.
Former presidential candidate and public proponent of ranked choice voting, Andrew Yang, explains how it's already begun to change the electoral process in these states. Let's take a listen.
You see these structures working in a place like Alaska, where Lisa Murkowski bravely voted to impeach Donald Trump and made it back through the primary because they did away with the party primary and said anyone can vote for anyone. Sarah Palin loses in that primary for the same reason. We have to change the structures and the incentives, or else we're going to reward bad behavior and we're going to see more of it.
Co-chair of the Forward Party, Andrew Yang, joins us now to discuss. It's wonderful to see you, Andrew.
Great to be here, Robbie. Yes, on three. And this also means independents can vote in the primary in Nevada. I know a lot of people watching The Hill are independents, and a lot of them are locked out of primaries. It's totally messed up. It's wrong. You're paying for elections you can't even participate in.
Yeah, so tell us more about what the Nevada proposal will accomplish. I understand this is going to have now, there's a five candidates advancement. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, the most important part is that anyone can vote for anyone in an all-party primary, so you don't have these party bosses essentially cordoning it off and saying, hey, here's your choice. You can vote for anyone. This also means that even if you're not in the party of the candidate you're trying to influence, they have to listen to you because they have to get 51% of the general public to support them, and not just the 10 to 12% on the side, or half of the 10 to 12% on the side, which, by the way, is deranging our politics. It's why so many Americans feel like we're on the outside looking in. There is a way out of this. You can get rid of the party primaries, and Nevadans raise their hands. By the way, both parties were against this. They said, hey, it's going to be confusing, it's going to be cumbersome. But common sense won, independent voters won, where the voters of Nevada said, you know what? I'd prefer it if you had to listen to me rather than us having to listen to you and take the choices that you're forcing on us.
Well, and you can see how this could actually, in theory, sober up the Republican Party a little bit, in that they keep advancing because, you know, the very vocal in the primaries kind of MAGA base keeps putting forward these candidates that fare so poorly in general elections when there were other better options, but the other better options can't survive, you know, against the hardcore Trump wing in the primary. So this would have, you know, the influence of independents and centrists and moderates could actually be good in some ways for the electoral prospects of more sane members of both parties.
Well, it would certainly make your nominee more electable. And one example that is not discussed at all is that Glenn Youngkin in Virginia was the product or beneficiary of a ranked choice voting system in Virginia, where there were some extremists running against Youngkin, and then Youngkin got the nod because of RCV in large part. And then he was more electable, and then he ended up winning in the general. Mm-hmm. And the clip you showed had me discussing Lisa Murkowski and Sarah Palin benefiting. I mean, Sarah Palin's the poster child for someone who would win in a normal primary but loses in the general. And so Alaska benefited. And what you just said is right, is that the parties actually benefit. The reason why they're fighting this is a mystery to me, because it's actually going to end up with much more generally appealing candidates if you want to win. The issue here is that parties actually aren't as concerned with victory as they are control.
So how did they pull this off? I mean, both parties were against it. What did they do right? How do you make something like this happen?
It was fun because I was in Nevada campaigning for this down the stretch, and you saw the ads. And the ads were that there was a military veteran saying, I served the country, I'm an independent, why can't I vote in the primary? I mean, it's pretty hard to argue against that. I was talking to a couple of porters on the strip who said to me, everyone I know is voting yes on three, because they just instinctively recognized that it was good for the voters Now, it's a big investment, frankly, to get those ads on TV and to spread the word. Because if the parties are against it, you need to have some resources to bear. And so grateful to everyone who decided to contribute to the Yes on Three Nevada Voters First campaign. And we're going to have to do it again in Nevada in 24 because of a quirk in Nevada law that says you essentially have to pass it twice. But you commented that this is the third state. And we're looking to expand this to other ballot initiative states in 2024 to turn off the polarization, to make it so that our elected representatives actually have to listen to us.
Right. So speaking about the electorate, a new Public Religion Research Institute poll found that 42% of Americans would vote for a new political party that's somewhere in between Democrats and Republicans, with Democrats more likely to vote for a centrist candidate than Republicans. Here's my question for you. It seems to me that there is a huge portion of the American electorate, of the American body politic, that has been sort of erased by the way our two-party system is set up. But so, and Robbie will probably disagree with me about this, but I think that those people tend to be the kind of people who are socially conservative, but economically more protectionist, let's say, right? More left wing, or what used to be left wing. The kind of people that actually Trump spoke to, where they want more government intervention in protecting jobs and protecting industry and protecting manufacturing, but they're also socially conservative. And I wonder, are these the kind of people that the Forward Party is speaking to and speaking for, or is it more the opposite?
Or is it speaking to culturally, well, not leftist, but culturally moderate, live and let live kind of people who right. think the government is overly tinkering in our economy,
right, the
perhaps.
The libertarians who are socially liberal.
Which way, centrist man?
to your point, Bacha, if you go around to red states, there's a broad amount of support for things like lowering prescription drug prices. Sorry, Robbie.
that one's a little different. I don't know. That one you can have.
Just common sense policies that look out for the everyday American. And it's not super ideological. You know, I mean, people are for public education. People are for public safety, for sure. People are for better health care. And really, the question is, how the heck do you get there? At this point, neither party has to truly respond to how the heck you improve the life of the farming community in Iowa or Ohio or for the family in Harlem. I mean, the fact is that right now, 37 states have one party rule. And in one party rule, do they really have to listen to you so much? So one of the goals of the Forward Party is to create real dynamism and choice in different communities. And it's going to look different in different communities. But the big themes of the Forward Party are just to make our communities thrive again. And that can mean different things to different people. But there's this hunger and this need. Butcha pointed out that story that said 42% want an alternative. I mean, if you look at the percentage of Americans who want a third party, it's actually more like 62%, with that 42% defining this moderate middle.
Andrew, what is your big takeaway from the election results? A disappointing night from the standpoint of Republicans in many ways, although they are going to take the House, it looks like. I know the Forward Party was supportive of Evan McMullen in Utah, who also had Democratic support and ran against Mike Lee and did not win, although got 40-something percent of the vote. What are your big takeaways?
No, we're in a 50-50 nation where the polarization, unfortunately, is getting worse, not better. And the question is, how the heck do we move forward right now in such a divided time? Like you said, Robbie, the Republicans will probably have the House very slightly. The Democrats will have the Senate very slightly. How much is going to get done? Probably not a whole heck of a lot. The clock's going to turn towards 2024. You are, in my opinion, more likely to see a Trump-Biden rematch because of the midterms, and that's one of the big impacts. And you're shaking your head, Robbie, because 58% of Americans don't really want that rematch,
right.
Aren't excited about either one.
Yeah.
Their combined age in 2024 will be 159 at the end of that year. And one of the major impacts of this midterm result is that 2024 rematch now, in my mind, is easily the most likely scenario.
A system that serves us up Hillary, Trump, Trump-Biden, and Trump-Biden, something has gone horrifically wrong.
Horribly wrong, my friend, that's right.
Most people would agree. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, guys. Have a great week.
Take
care. Great seeing you.
Ahead of the midterms, major Republican commentators predicted a red wave could happen if candidates focused on tough-on-crime messaging. In September, 29% of Republican campaign advertisements mentioned the word crime, claiming criminal justice reform and less policing in progressive cities has caused an increase in violence. Despite the predicted success of these tactics, Democratic candidates that were targeted in Republican ads for being soft on crime, like John Fetterman, they actually won their races.
Joining us now to discuss is host of A Fresh Perspective and contributor to Red State and Liberty Nation, Jeff Charles, and political journalist Rebecca Azor. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So let me start with you, Jeff, because I know you and I talked about this a lot. You wrote about it for Newsweek. What happened? You know, we were so sure that the crime wave was going to favor the Republicans, and that just doesn't seem to have materialized. Talk us through what happened.
No, it didn't materialize. But here's the thing. I mean, the issue of crime was a winning issue for Republicans. So they were right to harp on the policies that contributed to the issues that we're seeing as far as crime goes over the past couple of years. But Republicans made the same mistake that they make on almost every other issue and every other election. Very good at complaining about what Democrats are doing, not very good about offering an alternative. See, they were right when they were talking about how these soft on crime policies only protect criminals and they don't protect civilians. But Republicans never said, hey, you know, that plan isn't good, but this is what we've got going on. Here's how we're going to solve the problem. Republicans haven't realized that if there's a problem and Democrats put forth a faulty solution and Republicans don't put forth a solution, that problem still exists. So this whole crime issue was kind of just a microcosm of the overall election where Republicans failed to make their case.
Yeah, what do you think, Rebecca? Is this a message for the Democrats that really what they're doing is effective despite Republican complaints about how their policies on this issue? You know, what are Democrats going to take as a lesson from this?
Well, I think, you know, the focus being on crime and not actually getting the message across to me correctly was what was the issue for Republicans. It's just like putting out to me misinformation, the ads and everything associated with that. Democrats, to me, I feel like in this moment, they can focus, when they do focus on crime, it's more specifics. While I think that both parties can do better in, you know, explaining their cases, pushing information with stats and things like that, Democrats, I think in this particular portion of it, when it comes to crime, it's just, they were lucky, I think, for when it comes to this, topic. They could have done more as well, I believe, but I don't really think it was anything that was so spectacular that made Democrats have to look at it and think, oh, we won in this particular case. Both parties could have done better, but Republicans were pushing, to me, this one saying crime, 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 focusing on such a small portion of it, not really having any details. I just think it didn't work in their favor, for sure.
So interestingly, even though we're talking about how the Democrats, you know, in a way kind of won more than we were expecting, New York City Mayor Eric Adams blamed New York Democrats for having poor performance in the midterms on the state's bail laws in New York, saying, quote, everyday New Yorkers, particularly in the inner city, they don't want these repeated offenders. This catch, repeat, and release system is just destroying the foundation of our country. We are losing the base, black and brown people who really believe in those basic things.
According to a Pew Research poll, 82% of black Democratic voters said that crime was very important to their midterm vote, compared to only 33% of white Democrats. I don't know, what do you make of that, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, who have been the disproportionate victims of these high crime rates? It's been black Americans. And a lot of Democrats, like Governor Kathy Hochul is one of them, dismissed those concerns. So it wasn't surprising to me to find out that black people in America cite crime as one of their highest priorities. But again, I mean, Eric Adams is right. I mean, Eric Adams got elected because of a law and order platform. But if he's locking people up and they're being let out on this bail system, then it kind of defeats the purpose. Congress. But again, I'm going to go back to Republicans because, yeah, I don't agree with the progressive version of bail reform. I think it protects criminals, but that doesn't mean that there isn't an issue with our bail system. Where are the Republicans saying, okay, that plan sucks, but here's how we're going to address the issue and solve the problem? They're nowhere to be found. They're very good at complaining, but when it comes to providing actual solutions to provide an alternative to the American people, they have been lacking. I mean, these midterms were the Republicans to lose, and they did. I know they're probably going to get the House, but this is not a victory. So Republicans need to take a step back and really start to understand where they're going wrong and how they can improve their messaging.
Yeah, I mean, the New York Post had a piece about how in New York specifically, it was black voters that put Hochul over the edge over Zeldin, that they felt that Zeldin was just too Trumpy. He was too Trump aligned, and there was just no way that they were going to show up for somebody like that. Rebecca, I'm wondering, are we in a situation again where they're just, it doesn't seem like either party is focused on the needs of the black community?
I mean, I would say, excuse me, that if we look who is more focused on the needs of the black community, what's harming the black community at a disproportionate rate, we can automatically say it's the Democrats. I wouldn't say it's the Republicans, especially when it comes to the idea of crime. I think even with that, you know, they're pushing that in New York, Mayor Eric Adams, where's Olay when I need her? But she, you know, she talks about this often here on this platform about, you know, his push about crime and how much crime is happening there, how to put more police on the streets and funding them more to be on the streets. If police equaled more safety, then New York would be safe as hell right now. But they're not. It's not an area where I think he pushes crime and the over exaggeration on crime. That is apparent. However, I do think Democrats, if it came to it, are the ones, even though I don't think they're doing enough, they're the ones that actually have more of a focus on the needs of the black people.
No, I hear that. I mean, I have mixed feelings, admittedly, on this issue because I see the kind of problems in many of our cities, not all of them, but many of them with homeless people and suffering mental illness issues and the violence and the threats to people, the random beatings and stabbings and carjackings, et cetera. I want to do something about that. Obviously, something should be done about that. But then I don't know whether, you can't. It's hard to just detain people before they've been convicted of some crime. Some of these are mental illness problems. And can we keep people in facilities? We don't have the right facilities for them. And then I don't, as a libertarian, I don't like love the idea of throwing more and more money into policing, which can have these ancillary effects on police brutality and things like that. That said, we might need it in some cases. I don't know. It's a very frustrating kind of mixed bag for me. That's my perspective. I don't know. Jeff, how would you advise the GOP to talk about this from now on, given that they fell short on a tough on crime message, even though there really is, I think, underlying issues that need to be addressed?
You know, I think that there's a holistic messaging reform that the GOP needs. I mean, New York City has the most police officers. And compared to other cities, New York City actually isn't as bad when it comes to crime, but it's still an issue. But, I mean, we can't just say, just throwing more police at the situation is going to solve the problem. I mean, I might get in trouble with some conservatives here, but the progressives do have some good ideas when it comes to addressing these issues without necessarily throwing somebody in a cage. I mean, if they're nonviolent or if they're dealing with drugs, there might be other solutions to that. But the bottom line is that you can't have policies that protect criminals more than civilians. And I do think Democrats have been better at talking about these things and about addressing them. I don't think that they've been good about solving the problem, but they're at least willing to discuss it. Whereas on the right, we're just law and order, law and order, law and order. Okay, well, what's that going to look like? What does that look like for officers who abuse their authority? Does law and order apply to them? It should. So I think that Republicans can win on the crime issue because the competition isn't that great, but we have to fight strategically and fight wisely instead of just saying crime is a bad thing. I mean, anybody can say that.
If law and order means we have more police like we had in Uvalde, then what good is that going to do?
Precisely. Exactly.
All right, Jeff, Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
You Israel has a new government, and Bibi is back, baby. 2 weeks ago, Israelis went to the polls for the fifth time in 4 years and voted in a coalition headed by former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. This is the sixth time Netanyahu has secured the country's top job. He previously served as Prime Minister for 12 years before losing office in 2021. Now, Israel is a parliamentary system, so he didn't get more votes than the competition. What he did do was pull together a coalition where his opponents failed to.
Politician Itamar Ben-Gvir, who has himself been convicted by an Israeli court of inciting racism and supporting terrorism, is pushing to head the public security ministry. The office would give him control over police, prisons, and law enforcement at and around the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, a decades-long flashpoint in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. According to Israeli media, Biden administration officials have signaled that they will not engage with Ben-Gvir. Over the weekend, the Women of the Wall, a religious feminist group, issued a letter expressing concerns over the possible appointment, accusing Ben-Gvir of, quote, participating in massive violent protests that endangered our lives and continue to pose a threat to us every month. Here to weigh in on all of this and more are two brilliant thinkers, Omar Badar, a political analyst and former director of the Arab American Institute, and Shani Moore, an adjunct fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and a fellow at the Institute for Liberty and Responsibility at Reichman University. Welcome to you both, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Just so great to have you. So, Omar, you wrote a piece for us at Newsweek in which you disputed the idea that Ben-Gvir, this racist terrorist who is now part of Benjamin Netanyahu's ruling coalition, represented a break from the status quo of Israeli politics and was more sort of, you know, in line with what you see as a central tenet of Israel, its governing, and its relationship with the Palestinians. Walk us through that argument.
Sure. I don't want to downplay the extent to which it is dangerous to have people like Ben-Gvir holding security positions, because that is quite risky. And I think that we might see the consequences of that at some point in the near future. But if you look at the context from which Ben-Gvir emerged, I mean, just look at Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu himself, who said that Israel is not a country of all of its citizens, but specifically of the Jewish population. You see the prime minister before him, Yair Lapid, who says we need to build the wall to get the Arabs out of our sight. And then you have the prime minister before him, Naftali Bennett, who says that there is nothing wrong with killing Arabs. Those are three different prime ministers in a row from three different parties in Israel. So it's quite clear that anti-Palestinian racism is mainstream in Israeli politics. And Batya, worse than the politics and political discourse, is policy itself. Now every major human rights organization in the world, including Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, and even Israeli human rights organizations like B'Tselem and the United Nations, all agree that Israel is committing the crime against humanity of apartheid against Palestinians. That means that Israel denies millions of Palestinians freedom and human rights for no reason other than the fact that they are Palestinian. And in that political context, having somebody like Ben-Gvir emerge is simply a natural continuation of Israeli political discourse and policy as well towards Palestinians. And it's frankly a scandal that the United States, you know, talking about not wanting to engage with Ben-Gvir, they should not be engaging with the Israeli government entirely until the system of apartheid falls.
So, Shani, you spent your whole life thinking about democracy, worrying about democracy, thinking about it in depth in the Israeli context and elsewhere. I want to give you a chance to respond to what Omar said and to tell us how you see this new government.
Well, a new government hasn't been formed yet, and there's not a coalition yet. It's likely that Ben-Gvir and his party will be in the coalition, but it's not for sure. I definitely see his arrival in the coalition and his success in the recent election as something that's deeply disconcerting for all the obvious reasons. I would say that the roughly 10% of the population that voted for him, that voted for an openly racist and rather illiberal and anti-democratic worldview, has existed in the parliamentary elections in Israel throughout, and in fact, in other countries as well. In most parliamentary systems in the West, there is at least a 10% of a far-right vote with views that most of us would consider quite unsavory. One of the things that happens in a conflict situation, particularly in a conflict situation governed by the rules of social media, is that anything that's a worst case from the other side becomes, for its opponents and its enemies, emblematic. So social media will always be full of posts that people salivate over of people from one side of the conflict doing or saying something absolutely outrageous. I was a bit struck by the three quotes that Mr. Badar gave right now, because all three of them circulate quite a bit on social media. They're all three ripped completely from context, in many cases meaning the exact opposite. The Lapid quote is from a statement of Lapid about the importance of withdrawing from the territories. The Netanyahu quote continues the next sentence about the importance of equal rights for everyone. It rejects the slogan of state for all citizens, which internal Israeli politics is used as a description of a non-Jewish state. And even the Bennett quote is taken from, I'm not even going to get into it, but from a radically different context. These are the rules governing social media, but it's not actually how the dispute and how the reality has been lived in Israel. That is not at all to minimize the danger of Ben-Gvir or to minimize the gravity of his worldview or its radical incompatibility with most of what has been the legacy and the tradition of Israeli democracy. The moment that he's entering the government, something which looks likely, is, like I said, a concerning moment for everyone. It is, in a partial sense at least, quite a rupture. In an electoral sense, like I said, not as big of a rupture as we'd perhaps like to think. Mm. There has consistently been a minority of far right-wing, illiberal, anti-democratic voters in Israel, not terribly different from in other countries. The one difference in Israel is that because of the situation in the occupied territories, and particularly the civilian presence in the occupied territories, there is a place to act out much of this illiberal and anti-democratic fantasy, where in other countries, far-right, illiberal, anti-democratic types have at most a couple websites and aggressive tweeters.
Right. So that I wanted to ask you this, Omar, and also give you a chance to respond to everything Shani just said, but to what extent do you think Israeli democracy within, the borders of Israel proper is something that is different than what is happening in the occupation of the West Bank, where, you know, of course, I think we could all agree there's, a situation there that's not democratic, but that is, at least from the Israeli point of view, supposed to be temporary. To what extent do you recognize the democracy of Israel proper towards its Arab Israeli citizens who have 95, 96, 90 97% of the same rights as Israeli Jewish citizens?
Sure. Just to respond to the earlier comments real quick, I'll note that Benjamin Netanyahu also warned during one of his campaigns about Arabs voting in droves as a way to get Jewish voters to also turn out. So and Naftali Bennett also has a very extensive racist history. I think people should go and look at these quotes in context for themselves and decide what they actually mean. On the question of the difference between Israeli democracy within Israel's borders as recognized by the UN and the occupied territories, I do think there is a difference. Palestinian citizens of Israel are merely second-class citizens. They enjoy many of the rights that every Israeli enjoys, with many limits on who they can marry, what neighborhoods they can live in, on Palestinian refugees being able to return, and they can't because they're not Jewish. I mean, there is plenty of systemic discrimination, but I agree that it's a drastic departure from the situation in the occupied Palestinian territories, where millions of Palestinians live under Israeli control and they don't get to participate in these elections. They frankly have no rights at all. People in Gaza can't interact with the outside world because of Israel's siege on Gaza. At some point, Israel was not even allowing certain foods into Gaza, like potato chips and cookies and soda pop and so on. You're talking about a population that is living completely within the confines of what Israel allows them to exist as. And in the West Bank, it's the same. Traveling from one Palestinian town to another, you can't do it without passing through an Israeli checkpoint. So by any measure, you are talking about a population that is living completely under the control of Israel, and they have no democratic rights whatsoever. So in the case of Palestinian citizens of Israel, we can speak of discrimination. And in the case of Palestinians in the occupied territory, you can speak of complete denial of rights. And the fact that President Biden refers to this as a free and fair election, I think should be a scandal. In any other context in which a country systematically discriminates against a huge segment of the population simply because of who they are and what their ethnic and religious background is, we would not call that a democracy. It is apartheid, and it's way belated. It's way about time for the United States government to actually come around to recognize what every major human rights organization in the world has recognized.
Yeah, so Shani, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that, and then also a question. Donald Trump, claimed to be the most pro-Israel president ever. How will Netanyahu his relationship with Joe Biden, what will that look like?
I can answer the second question first, if you want. Netanyahu and Joe Biden are longtime friends. Both of them have a not terribly different view of the main interests that their countries have in the Middle East, in the larger Middle East, and on the Iran issue, and on the room for what is possible in the Israeli-Palestinian arena. I don't think that should be, in the short term, a terribly difficult relationship. But there are some real differences. And in particular, both of them represent domestic coalitions in one way or another with some very divergent views on a few really important issues. But I don't see any real fireworks in there. Do you want me to respond to the other things?
Yes, please.
Please do.
All right. Well, there were two categories of the things that were said. And one was regarding in Israel, and one was regarding in the territories. And again, a lot of these talking points are rehashed and well-worn, but there's nothing really behind them in any comparison with any other country or in any proper legal regime. This idea that refugees not coming into Israel is somehow a discrimination against Arab citizens of Israel is obviously nonsense. Refugees aren't allowed automatically into any country, and that's not a discrimination against an ethnic group within that country. This line about people not being allowed to marry is also nonsense. What's true in Israel is that since 2003, the law that was the only one of its kind that I know of in a democratic country, where marrying someone automatically entitled the spouse to have citizenship, even if the citizenship of the spouse was of an enemy nationality, that doesn't exist in Israel. That's equally true in every other country in the world. There is no country in the world that gives an automatic citizenship to somebody on the basis of being married to one of its own citizens, and absolutely no country that does it in a situation of war. In regard to the territories, of course the situation in the territories is difficult. To discuss the occupation without talking about how it came about and what sustains it is to totally pervert the discussion. The territories are occupied because Israel won a war where it was threatened with destruction, and the occupation is sustained for 50 years because at no point has the other side agreed to make peace. The occupation could end today with a peace agreement on two states, but it was the Palestinian leadership that rejected the possibility of two states in 2000 and in 2001 in Camp David and Dahabah, rejected it again in 2007 in Annapolis in 2008, rejected it again in 2013 and 14 in Washington, in the secret talks in London and in the talks that were mediated by John Kerry. That could end in a moment with a peace agreement. And the situation in Gaza, to describe it even as occupied, is to stretch the bounds of these legal definitions beyond anything that they're intended for. There's never been in history a territory that's called occupied where the belligerent army that's supposedly occupying it has exactly zero troops in it. What is in Gaza is a blockade, which is a perfectly normal act in a state of war. In fact, in almost every war where there has been the possibility for one side to impose a blockade on the other as long as the war was ongoing, that's been the reality. A blockade could be ended in Gaza the exact same way that the occupation could be ended in the West Bank, with a peace agreement.
We're going to have to leave it at that, you guys. But thank you so much for the back and forth. It's so rare that we get to hear both sides and that we get to hear people have civil disagreement on really important and difficult topics. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Welcome back to Rising. We have the lovely Amisha Cross joining us in studio as well. It's a packed day here at Rising. Good to see you, Amisha.
Glad to be here. I was going to say, I get intro'd as lovely today. I feel like, you know, things are changing up.
We could intro you as lovely every day as well. All right, Batya, what's going on at the moment?
Well, Twitter has reportedly suspended the ability to get verified due to impersonation issues.
Plus, a note was reportedly sent to the Twitter staff by the legal leader on its privacy team, part of which read, quote, "Over the last 2 weeks, Elon has shown that he cares only about recouping the losses he's incurring as a result of his failing to get out of his binding obligation to buy Twitter. He chose to enter into that agreement. Elon has shown his only priority with Twitter users is how to monetize them. I have heard Alex Spiro, the current head of legal, say Elon is willing to rake in a huge amount of risk in relation to this company. Because Elon puts rockets into space, he's not afraid of the FTC." End quote. That message suggested that Musk is at risk of putting Twitter in violation of its FTC consent decree, Alex Heath, editor at The Verge, stated.
Musk responded to all of the media coverage he's been receiving, saying, quote, in a since-deleted tweet, Twitter owner Elon Musk wrote, The awesome irony of the situation is that the media writing about Twitter and me failing nonstop is driving massive growth in Twitter.
So, been a lot of Elon stuff over the weekend. Every day there's more. So I'm worried now this whole thing from his perspective is based on a totally faulty premise, because he had tweeted that that Twitter drives massive traffic to other sites. It's this great refer of other, he said, he's claiming it was the biggest refer of traffic to other sites. That's not true. Right. it seems like it. To those of us in the media, it seems like it's this big, important site. It's important because the media is all there, policy people are there, but it actually doesn't drive a huge amount of traffic to other sites. The website he is thinking of is Facebook. That's not the one he bought. He bought Twitter. So I wonder if this whole thing is like, if he just made that basic error or something.
No, I think that he, in some ways, is Trump-esque. He likes to self-aggrandize, and he likes to make things sound bigger than they actually are. So he reported saying that things were great and more people were following. He didn't actually report any numbers of a growth in followers at all. That's an important thing to note here. In addition to, quite frankly, I don't think that the outflux of people, and we've talked about this before, Batya, the outflux of people has happened. Just folks deleting their Twitter and going away. We've heard from maybe six or so celebrities who blatantly said they were leaving. But for the most part,
people are still back.
Yeah, nobody's really worried about that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we talked about this before, but, you know, Elon Musk is a billionaire. Everybody he knows are other billionaires, right? Other people in the elite of the elite, famous people. You know, that's who he spends his time with, people who are super into Twitter, because as we know, Twitter is a platform for elites to police other elites, right? To make news for other elites with other elites. It has no normie potential, and because he doesn't know any normal people, this was totally lost on him. He thought, well, I love being on Twitter. I love going crazy on Twitter. I love getting all this negative attention and then, you know, changing the stock market and changing the stocks of my companies by tweeting things. Like, that's great. That makes me get, you know, this big high. Surely every person would want that. And of course, every person doesn't want that, right? That's where we go in, you know, in the media elites, in the political elites, people like him. But that is not an experience that average people are willing to buy into. Yeah.
Well, I will say, though, he has me on his side again a little bit in this dispute he had with Senator Ed Markey, who was complaining on Twitter that someone was able, I think a Washington Post reporter, deliberately tried to make a Markey account to see if he could get away with it and get it verified, and he did. This whole verification thing is a disaster so far. But then he was complaining about that on Twitter, suggesting exactly what I was kind of getting at in that read I have, that there's going to be some kind of investigation or some kind of government action. And I don't really particularly care for Elon's response to this, but would this not, again, be an example of, you know, government censorship or something if they're going to investigate him for having some kind of policy they don't like?
Right. I mean, I don't think that they should, you know, I don't know, see the place for government intervention here, but his sort of immature joshing around and trying to, like, own a senator on Twitter. It's exactly what you said last week, Robbie. He's trying to both be the moderator and be a player, and you can't have it both ways. If you want to be a Twitter troll, you can't literally own the platform, right, and then spend all your time on it trolling. What do you think of me?
There's no separatism here. I think you're exactly right on that. He was known to kind of be a troll before he took over, and I don't think that he's willing to let that go at all. I think he's absolutely fine trolling. He wants to continue doing it. There is something to be said to your point, Robbie. It is very frustrating to see what happened with the blue verification, because companies back and forth are getting, you know, copycats, essentially, shadow groups that are saying they are them. We saw it happen with Eli Lilly. We saw it happen with Pepsi. Pepsi endorsed Coke, which would never happen in the history of these beverage companies. It is frustrating, but it's also kind of funny to watch, because everyone except Elon knew it was going to happen.
Right.
Well, President Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, responded to questions about Joe Biden, saying that Elon Musk's acquisition of Twitter is worthy of being looked at over national security concerns and how that would work. Let's watch that.
Well, you heard the president yesterday, and the CFIUS process is the normal process through which transactions that might have a national security nexus get reviewed, and I will defer to the CFIUS process rather than comment on it further from this podium.
Yeah, and I think we got to be very careful here, because the history of the national security intelligence community having questions about what's going on social media has come out really badly a lot of times with Hunter Biden laptop, with what we're finding out from The Intercept reporting about how interested Homeland Security is, about whether you can talk about COVID, et cetera. Like, the government's interest in this has gone so far awry so many times, in my view. So it frightens me to hear them even saying that Twitter is on their radar. Get Twitter off your radar. Like, do something else with your time would be my response.
Well, so here's the problem is, you know, I don't trust the Biden administration to get this right. Now, there is a national security concern here, which we've talked about a lot, which is Elon Musk's very close relationship with the Chinese Communist Party. I personally think that TikTok should be banned. I think it's one of the ways that China is trying to undermine us, you know, not enough, you know, undermine our elections, but just to undermine our society, which is why TikTok is banned in China, because they know that it is extremely corrosive. I've always said from the beginning, the big fear with Elon Musk owning Twitter is not that it's going to become like Gab or like Parler, where there's hate speech, but that it's going to become like WeChat, where it's controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, because Elon Musk is controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, or if not controlled, maybe that word is too strong, but he is constantly bending the knee to them. He has never said no to them that I can see. He's built a showroom for Tesla in Xinjiang, which is where they're committing genocide against the Uyghurs. So on the one hand, there is a real, I think, national security concern. On the other hand, I'm sure that what the Biden administration is referring to is not China, but that there will be opinions that they don't like that are now allowed to proliferate on Twitter. What say you?
No, I think that Elon Musk is puppeteered by the Chinese Communist Party. That is what it is. And it's largely because of his own business interests, because there's money to be made here. He's not thinking in a geopolitical policy fashion at all. The frustrating thing that I see, to your point about TikTok, is that we have millions of users on this thing now, and it shows no signs of stopping. It is steadily becoming the fastest growing social media juggernaut. It provides an endless amount of information for the Chinese Communist government, period. They are able to mine people's data. They're able to mine the friends' data, the things that are shared there. That is, we've literally given it to them. And for a country that is so strict on surveillance, or, you know, individuals who don't want to be surveilled in any way by our own government, they seemingly have absolutely no problem with buying into surveillance of other governments.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think TikTok is a concern, and I'm concerned about, you know, obviously Elon, you know, being compromised. And because we have seen so many other, there's no successful right now corporation that has stood up to the China issue in terms of censoring their content. How many times do they fold? Do they eliminate if they're in a creative space, like, you know, storylines from movies and TV that are critical of China? That, you know, that is happening increasingly. So I am worried about that. But the U.S. government just has such a bad track record at this point of getting involved in these issues. So I would not expect the censorship sort of situation be improved by them looking very closely at this. All right, we'll have more Rising right after this. Stay with us. Comedian Dave Chappelle hosted Saturday Night Live this past weekend for the third time. In a report by Page Six, apparently not everyone was excited to have him back on set. Writers of the show reportedly wanted to have boycotted Chappelle's gig to protest comments made by him in 2021 that critics said were homophobic and transphobic. Let's listen.
He canceled J.K. Rowling, my God. But effectually, she said gender was a fact. And then the trans community got mad as shit. They started calling her a TERF.
TERF stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist.
A representative for Chappelle told Page Six that a meeting last Tuesday with writers showed no signs of a potential boycott, and that writers in the room showed apparent excitement for the veteran comedian's appearance. During his set on Saturday, Chappelle, of course, did not shy away from controversy, starting his monologue with comments about Kanye West. Let's watch.
Before I start tonight, I just wanted to read a brief statement that I prepared. I denounce anti-Semitism in all its forms. And I stand with my friends in the Jewish community. And that, Kanye, is how you buy yourself some time.
So he went on to tell a number of jokes that some people are saying were anti-Semitic and they shouldn't have done it. That joking about the amount of Jewish control in the media. He says some joke about how it's not offensive to say that, like, you know, you've got a bunch of Italians together running things, they're a mob, but you can't say the same for Jewish people. Look, I don't know. What is the difference between Chappelle making these jokes, between what Chappelle says and what Kanye says? I'd say it's weird and off-putting when Kanye does it, and Chappelle as a professional comedian has just a different cadence when he does it, and it's okay, but is that a totally hypocritical difference of opinion there?
Well, one is a world-renowned comedian, and the other one is just an off-kilter guy who says things that he seemingly believes wholeheartedly that are extremely problematic. I think that, you know, in that special, which I've now watched 5 times, so thank y'all for the extra clips.
Do you like Chappelle?
I love Chappelle. Like, he leaves no stone unturned, and he really does social commentary well, and I think he does it with a comedic spin, and that was what he was trying to do. Mm-hmm. Illuminate some things that obviously were in the media, Kanye's issues, then Kyrie's issues that apparently were spawned off of Kanye's issues and the reaction to it, but also that he didn't necessarily believe that, I think what came off for me was he didn't necessarily believe that Kanye was personally trying to attack Jewish people. And that, I think, is something that many people within my community honestly believe, that he said something, maybe he crossed a line, but he's not out here trying to actively advocate for harm to Jewish people.
That's really well put. I watched the cold open with Chappelle, I think like 5 times yesterday, because every time I watched it, I had a different reaction. Of course, you know, Jewish people on Twitter were debating back and forth whether the jokes were anti-Semitic.
Yeah, the Anti-Defamation League was quite upset.
The Anti-Defamation League was upset about it. You know, I would say the difference between what Chappelle was doing and what Kanye did is that Chappelle was telling jokes, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're allowed to tell offensive jokes. I would say the first joke he told, the one we just saw, was very funny. I mean, like, that's a great joke because, like, as a Jewish person, you watch that and it's hilarious because it's like, you know, he's making fun of the hesitancy with which you approach this topic, even as a comedian. You know, were there jokes later that I felt were, you know, made me uncomfortable? They did. But I mean, obviously, that is his prerogative as a comedian. It's to take on topics that make people uncomfortable. You know, but I did. I went back and forth between being like, these are hilarious jokes. I'm included in this. He's picturing people like me in this, and then being like, no, I'm the butt of the joke, you know, and it's, you know, I have to extend the grace that to let him make these jokes because, you know, we believe in free speech, we believe in comedy, we believe that people should be able to break boundaries, but did he go too far? I'm not sure. I just kept going back and forth on it, but I did laugh.
There's something to how you do it at the end of the day, and Chappelle is effective because he does it well, and Kanye did it in a way that made us all go,
I mean, he also talked about things that we knew were, like, were technically true. He says, okay, well, I've been to Hollywood. There are a lot of Jewish people in Hollywood. I've also been to Ferguson. It's a lot of black people in Ferguson. But do they run anything? I think that he's playing on the social ideology about what many people believe Hollywood is, and that, you know, it's got crazy things in and of itself that have absolutely nothing to do with Jewish people. It's just Hollywood. People in Hollywood are weird. But more so trying to break up the ice, because this is a very touchy subject, and I think he fully recognizes that, but he was able to bring light to it. The Anti-Defamation League was live tweeting the whole time.
I'm going to read their statement. So Jonathan Greenblatt of the Anti-Defamation League denounced Chappelle's monologue, tweeting, "We shouldn't expect Dave Chappelle to serve as society's moral compass, but disturbing to see NBC, SNL not just normalize but popularize anti-Semitism. Why are Jewish sensitivities denied or diminished at almost every turn? Why does our trauma trigger applause?" That's a pretty strong statement. And then obviously, given the initial boycotting concerns, Chappelle's gotten himself in trouble so many times. Lately, it's been for being perceived to be hostile to the transgender community or making jokes at the transgender community's expense. I don't know. That was a lot of anger there from the ADL.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Chappelle didn't deliver a TED talk on the topic of Jews in Hollywood. He told jokes about them. You're supposed to laugh at jokes, and especially if they're funny, and they were funny jokes. I will say, I do think, based on watching this, based on the other jokes he told about Jews, I do think that Chappelle maybe feels a little bit like Kanye, that it's not just that there's a lot of Jews, but that they do have a kind of control that, you know, makes it scarier to talk about them being there than other people. And, you know, I don't like that he believes that, but it's irrelevant, like, what I think he thinks in his heart of hearts. What's relevant is he delivered a set of jokes. Some were really funny, some were just kind of funny, but, you know, he took on a difficult topic in the best Chappelle way possible, which is to take on a very sensitive topic in a way that made people laugh. And I think, you know,
Chappelle also tells a lot of jokes about, like, poor white people and their drug addictions and their race. Like, he mocks white people all the time.
Yeah.
I'm not offended. No one's offended. Like, you don't talk
about
being offended.
I actually do get offended when he makes jokes about people like that. But again, it's his I'm offended by it, and it's his prerogative, and he should talk about whatever he wants.
I think one of the highlighting great things about him is that he speaks from an experiential experience.
Yeah.
He's talking about, hey, I live in Ohio. This is a segment of people that are around me in Ohio. I'm going to talk about this bar, this restaurant I went to, and the type of people I met. If you've ever visited or hung out in that particular part of Ohio and surrounding suburbs, you've seen many of the people who he's talked about. Mm-hmm. I lobbied there. It's very real. But he doesn't do it in a, I think, hateful way.
Yeah,
and I think that's the takeaway, that he's not trying to diminish these people. He is not trying to spread hate. He is literally out here showcasing to a world that doesn't necessarily see these things that this is what's going on, and actually trying to illuminate some of our societal issues.
Well, also, I think when you do, as he does, when you make fun of white people and black people and Jewish people and trans people from the position of being
it's the rainbow push coalition.
That way, it's harder to say that he has a specific malice against one group when he kind of jokes about who is in the headlines, and it's you know, all over the place. I mean, he's mocked his own community a lot. Chappelle's show was really funny. It took on a lot of black figures and black culture, etc. So he's done this to
no one is safe
groups,
and everybody could take an ill.
Which is the way, right, exactly, which is
and
the way comedy is supposed to be.
I will just make one more point, which is that I think that he is such an important voice for showing something that bothers me a lot, which is how the intersectional movement has stolen glory from the black struggle and then abandons the black community. You know, saying to support Black Lives Matter means to support, you know, the trans agenda, however far it goes. And like that, that bothers me a lot. And I think he has been a very strong voice for pointing that out.
It also bothers a lot of Black Lives Matter activists who actually are at the city and, you know, local level. That's more of a national Black Lives Matter thing than it is if you talk to Black Lives Matter activists in Chicago, in Memphis,
absolutely,
in various places across the South. That's not necessarily the mantle that they're going to take. Not that they're anti-trans, it's just when they're dealing with daily life, being able to afford rent, being able to get good jobs, being able to survive is a lot more of the context.
I think all that money went to buying the national organization a TikTok hype house, if I recall. That's what we've learned from the reporting. Oh, goodness. All right, we'll have more Rising right after this. Stay with us.
Former President Donald Trump continued to bring up his false stolen election narrative last week. In his most recent claim, he said he saved Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' 2018 bid in the gubernatorial election. Trump took to Truth Social Thursday, alleging, without evidence, that he sent federal agents to the state in 2018 to stop voter fraud.
These comments came after DeSantis' blowout reelection victory in the midterms and the increasing rumors following that he might run for president in 2024. If he does, it could pit him directly against Trump, who's expected perhaps to announce a run for reelection maybe this week, maybe tomorrow.
New York Representative Elise Stefanik is already backing Trump's reelection run, which he is expected to maybe potentially officially announce tomorrow.
What do you think, Bocci? Is he going to say, is he going to announce tomorrow? What's your bet?
I'm about to do something very silly, which is prognosticate, which I really try not to do, but I have never been convinced that he's going to run again, and I have never been convinced that if he does, that he will be the nominee. I've been saying on this show, I think for over a year now, that I think DeSantis would beat him in a Republican primary. So while I think Democrats may want him to announce tomorrow, while I'm sure the media wants him to announce tomorrow, there may just be enough Republicans close to him who can convince him that it would be a big mistake.
I agree with you on the second front. I agree that he is beatable by DeSantis. I don't think it'll be easy. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion. I definitely think it could happen. On your first point, that you think he might not run at all, that I do not agree on. I don't think he can help himself. I think he's going to make a go of it. And if he does horribly right away, he'll find some way to bow out. I'm not sure that will happen because I think he'll be competitive, at least, against DeSantis.
So if you had asked me 6 months ago, I would have agreed with Bacha. I did not think that he was going to run. I thought this was just a huge grift. He was going to collect money. He was going to enjoy the media attention. He was going to run from scandal because that's what he does. Coming off of Republicans taking major L's in this midterm election cycle and a lot of them blaming him, which a lot of it's his fault, this is somebody who cannot handle that. So at this point, I think he is out to prove something to them and out to prove something to himself. I think he's definitely going to run. He's definitely going to announce, whether it's tomorrow or any other time in the near future before the Georgia runoff, because he does not care about the Republican Party. Trump is here for Trump and doesn't care about being a liability. He's going to announce. He's going to run. Now, I think Ron DeSantis is a better candidate in that pool. There are going to be several people who run in the Republican Party at this point because Trump has appeared to be a wounded animal. But Ron DeSantis, I think, has a better shot.
Yeah. He's got to complete the trifecta and lose Georgia for a third time.
Right.
Just the appeal of doing that from a numbers standpoint.
Right. Now, Misha, let me ask you this. Like, as a Democrat, could you see yourself, like, what is your relationship to DeSantis? I mean, because we were told so often that the objection to Trump was his demeanor, was his norm breaking, was his sort of like undignified way of expressing himself, all of which I think is true. But now you're starting to see this thing coming out of the Democrats, which is, you know, DeSantis is worse than Trump because he's Trump, but he's more effective. Where are you on that, on those sort of two options?
100% agree. DeSantis, and I've said this time and time again, DeSantis is a smarter version of Trump. He knows how to get legislation passed. He knows how to win people over. He doesn't have to come through bombastic. He can do it without those things. He is someone who understands his people. He's someone who took a lot from the Trump playbook, but he tweaked it in a way that doesn't come off sounding as offensive to the unseen eye. Like, I think that he is very attentive to what Trump's mistakes were. And he's acknowledging what those were, and he's trying to sidestep them in a way, but still being oppressive to multiple groups of people. This is a guy who did the Don't Say Gay bill. This is a guy who has absolutely no problem with trying to dismantle all of the efforts of the Black Lives Matter movement. This is a guy who wanted prosecution of those who are protesting in the streets. Like, nothing about Ron DeSantis is great.
So you're not gonna breathe a sigh of relief if it's DeSantis instead of Trump.
Absolutely not. I just don't think he's going to lead us into an insurrection.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Well, that's what I like about it. The riots, the one riot that Trump inspired, being so deeply embarrassing and humiliating, and should have rightly humiliating to the conservative moment. I want to know what DeSantis's foreign policy views are.
Totally.
That's what I want to know.
Right,
that's the most important question.
Yeah,
he's not been tested on that front. It's not his fault that we don't know what they are. But he does
have a military background, which we can't say for the majority of people who've run for president as of late.
That's true.
That's not an endorsement of Ron DeSantis.
But that could go either way. That could be some, because of a military background, could be more inclined toward hawkish, although there's always that, you know, from long ago, the stat of the actual veterans supported, like, Ron Paul in the Republican primaries years and years ago. So I want to know, because we're at such an important inflection point for conservatives and foreign policy. The direction, the trajectory is for the Republican Party to actually become the anti-war party or the anti-foreign interventions party. There is more opposition to endless funding of Ukraine in the Republican, in the House side, the Republican House of the side, rather, than the Democratic side. And I'm honestly not exactly sure where Trump fits into that either, because he often articulated a non-interventionist, non-hawkish foreign policy, but then in practice, because, you know, he's not sincerely committed to any real philosophy, that doesn't come through there. He didn't pull out of Afghanistan despite saying he would. He left that to Biden. I would like to know what, you know, Trump's feelings are there too as well, but I think I'll never quite be satisfied with it because he doesn't have a philosophical commitment. What does DeSantis feel about it?
I'm not absolutely sure that the American pressure for foreign policy is what you think it is. There are a lot of people who are extremely upset about funding towards Ukraine because of the inflationary cost here. That's understood. But when it comes to debates, when it comes to conversation about foreign relations and foreign policy, that's the least watched one in any election cycle. The general American public, again, does not have that strong of an understanding of what's going on in terms of our geopolitical context in many senses. Unless we're directly engaging in a war, they're not necessarily the most involved. This is a little bit of a different case because economically, so many people are having trouble feeding their families back home that they don't want to hear news story after news story of how many billions are being sent to Ukraine.
Right.
Right. But so I guess, okay, my question would be, to what extent do you think Democrats would look at, for example, the, you know, Don't Say Gay parental rights and education bill, or look at DeSantis's COVID policies, or look at his relationship with protesters and say, you know what? I don't agree with these positions, but these are legitimate positions for someone to have, versus how they treated Trump, who was, you know, as sort of outside the norm, such a threat to the institutions themselves that people would argue, we can't act, these are not legitimate points of view because they're too far outside the norm. Do you think that there could be like a healthy debate, I guess, around some of the positions he's taken, or do you see him as a continuation of Trump being sort of outside what's legitimate to debate about?
I think Ron DeSantis is smart enough to know that Florida is an outlier mm-hmm. in terms of not only the lead that he was able to take, but in terms of the sizable gains Republicans made. I've told Democrats time and time again, Florida is no longer a swing state. It is solidly Republican. But I do think that he understands that to win a Republican primary, he's got several states before he even gets to Florida that he's mm-hmm. going to have to win that have very different demographics. He can stand on, and I believe he will, economic gains during COVID. Mm-hmm. There are several Democrats who might have a problem with some of the way he talked about COVID during its most dark days. But when you look at the numbers, the businesses that still stayed open, the schools that were still successful, Florida has one of the most successful public schools in the country in terms of their school districts. There are certain things he can run on that aren't necessarily as challengeable as his culture war arguments. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I agree with that.
It's really smart.
And Republicans have to find a smart way to talk about the culture stuff. Clearly, the constant, forecasting drag queen or foregrounding drag queens and all of that, which really pays off well in conservative media, it was clearly not top of voters' minds in this election. Even though I might agree with some of the conservative pushback to on gender and other things, it's gone too far in what some liberals want to do. I don't think
it's not something issue. People are voting on. Right.
Yeah, they were right. It's not. And the Republicans didn't offer despite this economic situation we were in, they didn't explain what they were going to do differently on
Yeah,
inflation.
And we talked about that a lot. On the one hand, they're right that the Democrats don't seem to be able to combat inflation in a way that's compelling. On the other hand, okay, what are you going to do about it? And they kept saying, something you love, Robbie, less spending. But I think for the American people, it's like, well, that spending already happened. What's that going to do tomorrow to bring down the price of chicken, to bring down the price of gas?
Way less spending. They say less spending. I say so much less spending. You haven't seen less spending.
I also question, what is the less spending on? Because if you're an American who is in need of healthcare services, if you're an American who wants to see better schools, if you're an American who wants to see, these structures of social change, there's a certain amount of spending that comes along with that. So when anybody says less spending, I'm questioning, what are you spending less on?
Defense spending.
I would agree with you on that.
But I would also gut education spending. I don't think it's. I don't think it's being spent well. I don't think we have enough to show for it. It's not justifiable. That's a longer conversation. We're going to have to let it go. I should mention earlier. I said I want to know DeSantis's foreign policy views. I should emphasize not just Ukraine. I want to know how he feels about China. I want to know what does he feel about Iran and changing the deal. There's so many.
And there have been governors to your credit who have, because when you think foreign policy, you don't think governors. That you think senators. Congress people, there have been governors who have spoken out about these things.
Yeah.
I think in alignment with their Senate cohorts. DeSantis has not. Yeah. And I think that he's playing that game smartly. Again, I think he's a lot smarter than the media gives him credit for. He's not trying to get caught to trick back too early. It's a long road to 2024. Mm. The popularity you have today could be gone in 6 months.
Well, we'll see if that road begins tomorrow, dependent on whether Trump announces. So good to have both of you in studio today. This is so much fun. Let's do it again sometime. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss any content. And for those of you who like to listen while on the go, we are now available anywhere that podcasts are available. We're also on Roku and other streaming services. I'll see you back here tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in.